Chapter 9. Television Cable Years. I am now 50 years old, and we have sold our Ely radio station and television cable system for $250,000. And we hurry to Los Angeles, where lived a brother and sister who had been urging us for years to come and live there in what they called paradise. We buy a house, just being completed in plush Brentwood, for $65,000. Years later, we call a neighbor and ask what that house is selling for now, and he said $200,000. Such is California real estate. We lounge in this beautiful new home high up at the top of Kenter Canyon, looking down on houses all with swimming pools. Our sons play with the sons and daughters of famous movie stars living all around us. The sons are not the least bit impressed, but we are. We also learn that real California residences do not think much of opulent movie stars. The movie stars have come up too fast and do not know how to handle wealth. And I go to get a Sears credit card at the nearby Sears store, and I'm turned down. When I answer that credit card application, I honestly answer the question of where I am employed. I write, unemployed. That black man immediately behind me in the line I was in got his credit card instantly. He worked for such and such company and was earning $150 a week. I've never learned how to handle defeat, so I immediately write a letter to the Sears company district manager in San Francisco and explain that I was not exactly broke, that I just had sold my radio station in Minnesota, and I expected a credit card. A few days later comes a phone call from the local Sears store manager. There had been a terrible mistake, and would I come by and meet him over a cup of coffee and pick up my credit card? He turned out to be a delightful gentleman who had been in California only 3 years himself. I do not recall buying anything at that Sears store, but I did carry their credit card in my pocket as long as we were there. Several times my brother drove us to the Golden Cock, a plush eating place across town. There was always an hour and a half wait before you got a table, but you did not mind. You drifted over to the cocktail lounge, and always we would find someone there from Minnesota or Wisconsin. When your name was called an hour or more later, you were reluctant to leave your newfound friends. We found there were more Midwest people in California than there were native California people. It was hard to find a native California person. Such was California. But I cannot handle idleness, and I team up with Jay Tapp, a radio station consulting engineer, and we go to Tucson, Arizona, to do some special engineering work for a radio station there. I learn I do not like Tucson, too dry and barren, with nothing green around unless you count a beautiful home with a concrete lawn painted green to resemble a green Minnesota lawn. In Los Angeles, every day was exactly the same. Blue sky, temperature 70 degrees. I was so bored. I found I had to have a stiff cocktail before dinner every night, and I figured it was time for me to get out of there. And I did. I got on an airline plane and flew to Minneapolis, where the temperature that day was 10 above, and a stiff wind blowing, and I felt great. I set up a radio station consulting office in a beautiful new office building at 1702 East Lake Street. I announced to the trade that I was there to help stations with engineering problems and was swamped with work. But that was not what I wanted. I was using that office only as a base to locate something more permanent. And I found it. Ed Nichols, the station broker who had handled the sale of my Ely properties, showed up leading me to a group of Sioux City businessmen who had banded together in investments. So, the Valtronics Corporation was formed, and I was commissioned to locate Midwest cities where a cable TV system could be built. Then came weeks of travel over Minnesota and Wisconsin, studying cities with cable TV system potential, preferably a group of cities which could be managed with one central office. And I found such a group. Marshfield, population 16,000, Merrill, population 10,000, and Wisconsin Rapids, population 18,000. I waded in, attempting to get a franchise from city governments in all three cities. A franchise is required before you can string your TV cables down city streets and alleys. The Ely City Council had asked me to write my own, But time had gone by, and now city councils insisted on lawyer-written franchises 30 or more pages long. In all three cities, local people rose up to fight me. They had always planned to install cable TV systems in their town, but never got around to it. Now a stranger in their midst, and they rose to fight me. Somehow, in Marshfield and Merrill, I won out getting the franchise. In Wisconsin Rapids, I struck out. When I left the area years later, there was still no cable TV system there. It's a paper mill town, and all councilmen were laborers at the mill. And they just could not be convinced that TV cable running down an alley would not kill all antenna TV reception in town, forcing voters to subscribe to the cable or do without TV. But it was Merrill that was dear to my heart. In spite of local competition, I got the franchise. It helps to be good-looking and wear a business suit while your competition appears in shirt sleeves and smokes through the meetings. One councilman wanted to know how I was going to get Jackie Gleason through that little pencil-sized cable from alley to the TV set. But the councilmen were businessmen, and they were anxious for a new industry to come into their town, and they bent the rules at the meeting where I was awarded a franchise. City rules required that any such franchise be read 3 times over 3 council meetings over 2 months. The franchise was read 3 times, all right, at that one meeting, boring the hell out of all of us for over an hour. 3 merchants sent me a letter welcoming me to their town that I later bought from all 3, including a Ford truck. Wonderful town. Do set up business there. Now, my Valtronics company gets into action. I hold 26% of the stock. The remaining 7 Sioux City, Iowa businessmen hold the remaining 74%. We all put money in, and a New York bank supplies a loan of $800,000. I put up a 600-foot receiving tower in both Marshfield and Merrill, and string miles of cable all through both towns. But cables have to be strung on poles. You can set up your own poles and antagonize prospective customers by setting up poles in their alley or on the city-owned boulevard in front of their home. Or you can rent space on existing telephone company or power company towers. In the end, that is what you do. In Marshfield, the poles I needed were owned by the power company, and I had no trouble getting a contract with the local manager, who drank scotch, and a case of scotch seemed to pave the way. In Merrill, all the poles in town were owned by the telephone company, and I found myself dealing with a telephone man who drove over from Appleton, Wisconsin. He not only did not drink scotch, but never drank anything stronger than black coffee. And he was tough. I learned later he was a bachelor, and so had never learned humility or how to be humble. I did get my pole contract, but we had many a battle after that, and at one time ordered me to tear all my cables off his poles. I've learned to do business with married men. They've learned how to be humble. My main office is in Marshfield, and I spend most of my time there. I am, however, at my Merrill office 50 miles north at least 2 days a week. At my Marshfield office, I have Isla Seidel, a middle-aged woman who is very serious and a good Catholic. She complains that the congregation in her church now sings, and she does not like that. On Christmas Eve, she always had a birthday cake with 1 candle on the table at home. I ask, "Whose birthday?" And she very icily answers, "Can't you guess?" I never bring it up again. When we have 1,000 customers, the monthly payments pour in by mail. Some envelopes show the names of different stores or business places downtown. She remarks that she suspects those people are making their home TV payments in those envelopes, and she says, "I bet they're using company postage, too. That's stealing." I do not have to worry about her handling money in my office. In my Merrill office, I have another delightful lady, about 50 years old. Her name is Caddy Dabberany, and I notice she often stands by the front counter indulging in conversation with lady friends as they discuss whose husband is going around with whose wife. After some of those conversations, she might come back to my desk and remark, "This is not Merrill, this is Peyton Place," a popular TV soap opera of that day. At a meeting, my stockholders ask me if I have bonded my employees, inasmuch as they handle considerable amounts of cash. I say no, and they order me to. So, reluctantly, I take on this extra expense, and the ladies and myself are bonded. My stockholders ask if I am keeping close track of the cash at my Merrill office, where I'm there only part-time. So, one Sunday morning, I drive to Merrill at 8 o'clock in the morning, and for 2 hours, fine-tooth examine accounts paid and bank deposits, and I find exact accounting almost to the penny. Then I sneak away and never do tell Catty of my Sunday morning visit. Two wonderful women. I wonder if there are any more like them around these days. Then, there was that time in 1965 when we flew in my plane to Denver to attend a convention. Conventions are usually days of hard working sessions and are not all fun and booze like some people think. Anyway, it was the trip back home that got interesting. In my plane was June and myself, plus our youngest son, Kim, who was 13 years old. Now, the elevation of that airport is 5,853 feet, which means you are almost 6,000 feet in the air before you even take off. So we take off, and it's a warm day, and our little plane is heavily loaded, and we climb out only about 100 feet per minute. After a bit, June says, "Why are we flying so low, Charlie?" And I tell her the plane is doing the best it can. But as the miles go by, the land falls way below us, and we do gain some altitude. As we approach Omaha, I radio down to the FAA station there asking about weather ahead, and they startle me by saying some bad weather seems to be gathering in central Wisconsin, and suggest I contact FAA at Mason City, Iowa, when I come near there. I swing north toward Mason City and radio on to FAA there, and they say they heard me talking to Omaha. There definitely was some bad weather gathering in central Wisconsin, and added that I might make it as far as Rochester. I never fly anywhere on a might, so I slant down to the runway there. It's now 6 p.m., and we've been enjoying cool, dry air at 5,500 feet. But now we have to come down to 95-degree, hot, humid Iowa air on the ground. When we landed, the airport operator had already gotten us a room at the Holiday Inn, and a car was on its way out to get us. Airport operators do this for those who fly small planes. We had dinner and retired to a cool, comfortable room while I telephoned on to Marshfield, trying to reach our two sons, Mark and Scott. But they did not answer, and I gave it no further thought. Then at 10 p.m., as we watched the 10 o'clock news on the screen, comes the news that a tornado had roared through Marshfield, Wisconsin, toppling a 600-foot TV tower. Believe me, I sat up straight in bed with that news. I grabbed the phone and called our cable TV office. Son Scott answered, and his first words were, "Don't panic, Dad. Mark already has emergency antennas up and has all three TV networks back on the cable and is about to add another channel or two." He said the tower had gone down about 6 p.m., and that he had been on the phone ever since, calling TV stores, getting antennas rushed out to them while Mark was out in the raging storm putting those antennas up on a small tower by the office. Much more conversation, and when I knew all was well there, I sank down in bed, and in the dark comes a small voice from son Kim in the next bed, saying, "Remember, Dad, how you used to worry about the tower blowing over? Well, tonight, you don't have to worry about it." The next morning, we resumed flying home in bumpy air. The air is always bumpy for some hours after a violent storm. When I got to the tower site, there were swarms of people on the grounds. People like to look at fires and wrecks, and I found our sons had already notified the insurance adjuster, and he was on the grounds. Everything had been taken care of. I was not needed at all. Sons Mark and Scott were 16 and 17 years old then. When this emergency arose, they did not wait for Dad to tell anyone what to do. They just went ahead and did it. What great sons they were and are. When you have a business in two towns and an office in each town, you have to decide which town to live in. You'll find yourself living in the town where your business has the most problems and requires the most attention. So you move your family into that town, and ideally have a mistress in an apartment in the other town. But, unhappily, the economics kept me from achieving the ideal, so I settled with moving the family into a lovely home in Marshfield and a plain, inexpensive room in a decaying downtown hotel in Merrill, and no mistress. We businessmen do have to sacrifice sometimes. Now, I am in the cable TV business, and I am buying advertising and not selling advertising. What would be the most effective advertising and get me the most for my dollar? I tried all kinds of advertising. I quickly found out that door-to-door advertising got the most new customers and the most problems. The salesman, working on a commission, would promise the customer everything. Then, a month or so later, when the first bill hit the customer, that's when the phone rang in our office with a very angry customer on the phone. In the end, I reluctantly gave up door-to-door selling. The newspapers did a fine job. I would run a half-page ad in the evening paper offering to buy the TV receiving antenna in the backyard, and the office phone would ring like mad until noon. Then the phone would become silent and ring no more. Direct mail was a disaster. I would spend a lot of time designing a beautiful brochure offering a prize to each new customer. Then I would take cardboard boxes of brochures to the post office and sit back and wait for orders that did not come. Once I went to the post office and had an argument with the postmaster, accusing him of taking those boxes of brochures out to a dump truck and not delivering them. Then I got sneaky by addressing brochures to myself and members of the staff to see if they were actually delivered. They were. So I gave up on direct mail, and I bought some billboards, which later I decided was dumb. It was very expensive, and I guess the reason I bought was because the salesman was a friend of mine, who had just been fired from his radio job, and I felt sorry for him. Then I tried radio, and that worked. It was low-cost advertising, and it was always there day and night, reminding people of cable TV service. People talking to people, like door-to-door, without the problems of door-to-door. I liked radio, and I kept it going in both towns, and when I moved to Brainerd, I had complete confidence in KVBR advertising. Then came the days when each of the cable TV systems, at Marshfield and Merrill, got their 1,000th customers. That called for a full-page ad in the respective newspapers showing a good-sized picture of the first customer alongside a picture of the 1,000th customer, plus a list of all the TV programs one could receive if you were on the cable. All went well in Marshfield with Arnold Weber, the first, and Marie Hurl, the 1,000th. In Merrill, however, things came out differently. But then Merrill is a different kind of town. A happy, lovable town where things happen. In this full-page newspaper ad was a picture of our first customer, Fata Voigt, the mayor of Merrill. Beside his picture was the picture of our 1,000th customer, a man whose name escapes me. After the paper was out on the street and in everyone's homes, my office manager, Ketty Dabereiner, came to me, ashen-faced, confessing that it had completely slipped her mind when we picked the 1,000th customer that this man had just served time in prison for molesting women, something everyone in a small town like Merrill knew. Horrified, I called Mayor Fata Voigt and confessed to our error. His picture, alongside the picture of this man. Fata just laughed and told me to forget about it. Fata Voigt had been the mayor of Merrill for the past 15 or more years and was always going to be the mayor, a much-loved figure in town. Fata always electioneered like mad come every election, and puzzled, I asked him why. Everyone knew he would be elected again. Why go on the campaign trail? Fata laughed and said, "At election time, I always run scared, something today's politicians should give thought to." After the Marshfield Tower blew down and the new tower had been shipped in, I held an all-day-long tower-raising party with generous coffee and donuts or cookies. My thought was that townspeople should come out and watch the excitement and maybe sign up for cable service. Lots of people did come, including one couple from the next town, who showed up every day, enjoying our refreshments and never would-be customers. Every morning about 7 a.m., the tower men would gather in my office at the foot of the tower for a last bit of coffee before they went up the tower. One day, I had an idea. I said to the crew, "Why don't you take a dummy of a man up the tower, and when there is a goodly crowd gathered below, drop the dummy with the tower chief saying to the crowd, 'Damn, there goes another man, my best one, too.'" The tower men, sitting there, said not a word, but quietly moved on out. I guess I had said the wrong thing. One thing about tower men, those men anyway, it was regular pay scale Monday through Friday, but double time on Saturday and Sunday. And if it were too windy to go up through the week, They did not have to go up. But somehow, it never seemed too windy to go up come Saturday and Sunday. I puzzled over that, but never came up with an answer. And in Marshfield, down by the railroad tracks, was a most delightful family restaurant. Red tablecloths, white napkins, gleaming silver. In fact, one time when June and I were there, the Girl Scouts held a meeting there using several tables pushed together. The one strange thing about this dining spot was through an open door to the next room was the toughest pickup bar in town, sought out by a pretty rough sort of men. When we first started going to that dining room, we would park on that side of the building and walk through the bar to the dining room, with every man at the bar turning to look June over. I said, enough of that, and from then on we parked on the other side of the building and walked a longer way to get into the dining room. It was at Marshfield that I, one time, hired an expert out-of-town lady to call on homes selling TV cable service. When she came, I asked her what part of town should she go calling on homes, where the wealthy people lived, or that part of town where poor people lived. She said she wanted to do her selling in the poor part of town. She said those people will buy anything. That's why they're poor. Maybe so. Then there was the poor gentleman who I hired to also do door-to-door selling. He was working at the local Montgomery Ward store, but decided to come with me. As Montgomery Ward hires only top-notch people, that was good enough for me, and I made no attempt to check his background. But the town required people going door-to-door to get a peddler's license, so I submitted his name to the police department in a routine way. A couple days later, the police chief called me and suggested I come down to the police station. I did, and the chief showed me this man's record. In other towns, he had been arrested a couple times for breaking into homes. Here, I was having him call on people, representing my company, and I suppose sizing up the home with who knows what in mind. I called our man in and confronted him, and he cried, saying he had reformed and was very upset losing his newfound job with me. But I had to be firm. The first house robbed in town would have the police swarming all over me in my office looking for him, even though he might have had nothing to do with the robbery. The criminal does indeed lead a tough life. I don't recommend it. I did not have a weekly radio program in Marshfield or Merrill, but I did have a weekly column in the daily newspaper in Marshfield. Howard Quirt, publisher of that paper, told me more than once that my column was the most read column his paper ever carried. Howard Quirt and his wife, Lila, became close friends, and we so often spent an evening at their big, beautiful home with tall white pillars in the front. Howard and I would sit in his library, lined with bookshelves, cocktail in hand, and talk about times of past. He knew my father so many years before, and Howard would tell me they were thinking of moving to a smaller, modern home, as this big house was now too hard to keep up. And I so strongly urged him to stay, to never give up the gracious living they had and were enjoying. Lila, who was the social leader in that town, included June in so many important social events. We left town to move to Brainerd, and we lost track of them, but we did hear that shortly after we left Marshfield that they passed away quite close together. Two wonderful people from the gracious days of the past, and today we are poorer for it. Here follows is a copy of one of my weekly newspaper columns. Cable Chatter. A cold wind was blowing across the airport, and June stood close to me so I would break the wind for her. I stood with my back to the wind and watched the north central plane swing once around the airport and then gracefully land over across the field. June was not looking. Instead, she was biting her lip, which was quivering, and I knew she was close to tears. The plane came up, a door opened, and down the stairs walked a slim, straight, handsome young man in the uniform of our proud army. Our son, Mark, had come home. Suddenly, June, our other three sons, and myself were all laughing and crying and slapping Mark on the back, and I was trying to take pictures, only I couldn't see very well as my eyes were wet. The wind or something, you know. Then we all got in the car and drove home. And everybody was talking at once, just like we had to say everything before we got home. At home, I told Mark, I would carry his duffel bag in the house, but the weight made me stagger. Mark only laughed. picking up the bag and easily swung it over his shoulder and walked inside. The army builds muscles, whereas I have only been building fat these past years. In the living room, Mark and his older brother, who is an officer in the Army Reserves now, talked military language, while the rest of us listened, but understanding only part of it. I sat back and was terribly happy. The living room was full of life again. For months now, the house had been so quiet, with only one son left at home. But now, a son had come over from Minneapolis, another from college in Northfield, Minnesota, and now Mark was here, and we had our four boys together again. June was humming softly as she prepared dinner in the kitchen, and the odor of baking ham was in the air. Then we all sat down at the table, and I looked around. At the other end of the table was beaming and lovely wife and mother, June. Around us, four grown sons. We had sat at that table so many times in the past, but now it was different. Where were the little boys who used to sit on a pillow so they could reach their plate? Where were the little boys who used to play little tricks on each other at the same table? Where were the little voices excitedly talking about their play, their games, and their school? Now those same little boys were sitting around the table with us again, but now their voices were deep, and their talk was about grown-up things. I looked across the table and I saw June looking at me and smiling. Then we all bowed our heads to say grace together, and deep voices now thanked the Lord's blessing on our food, instead of the little voices of yesterday. Only my voice was missing. I was too choked up to say anything, and I noticed June's voice was wavering. Our son Mark had come home from the army, and we were all together again. Charlie Persons, Manager. It was April 1967, 2 months before we moved from Marshfield to Brainerd. June became ill in what seemed a simple cold, but the fever came, and she was ill. Not our regular doctor, but a substitute doctor came. They still made house calls in that town, and he suggested she had the flu and should take aspirin and orange juice. But June was really ill, and a couple days later I noticed her abdomen was distended and hard to the touch. Dumb as I am about medical things, I knew something was very wrong. It was late afternoon, and I bundled her into our car and dashed off to the emergency room at the hospital. There, the test began, and late in the evening showed her abdomen filled with peritonitis, a deadly fluid that almost certainly results in a patient's death. The doctor decided they could not wait for 7 a.m., the usual hour for operations, but it had to be done immediately. So in the evening hours, surgeons, anesthesiologists, operating room nurses came hurrying in from the countryside, and the operation began about 11 p.m. I sat in the deserted waiting room below, with the lights turned low and so very quiet. The Lord heard from me that night, I tell you. That was a long night. About 3 a.m., a nurse came and told me they were bringing her down now. I ran out in the hall and saw her on a stretcher, her face gray and flabby, like a dead person. The nurse lied to me, saying, "She'll pull through all right. Why don't you go home and get some rest?" I went home, but not a lot of sleep I got that night. At 7 a.m., I was back and found she was in the intensive care room, but she still was out and didn't know I was there. By evening, she was awake, but hardly recognized me. A day or two later, I was back. In fact, I almost lived in that hospital and saw she was moving around while I thought she would be lying quiet to gain strength. I asked her why. She could not talk, could only whisper, and when I put my ear close to her mouth, I heard her say, "The doctor told me I should move around to get well faster." So, at that early, terrible moment, she was fighting to get well so she could be with her husband and her children. A couple days later, I met Doc Vetter in the hospital hall. He was one of the two surgeons who operated on her. The other was Doc Rice, and he said to me in words that still ring in my mind, "I've never had a patient who fought so hard to live. She is magnificent." That's our June. I learned the surgeons had drained the peritonitis and had removed several diseased organs. When she could talk, she learned the names of the nurses, where they lived, how many children they had, and the nurses loved her. There was a strict rule in that hospital, no flowers in the intensive care room. But there were flowers, and lots of them. The nurses ignored the rule. She was moved to a private room, and one afternoon, sitting there, I looked up, and who should be standing there but Roger, my son by my first marriage, to Gertrude. Startled, I said, "How did you get here?" He laughed and said, "Oh, I was on my way to see a customer, and I just stopped by." He was a traveling salesman covering northern Illinois and southern Wisconsin. He stayed a couple of days sitting by her bed and then moved on. Before he left, I asked him, "Where was that customer you were calling on when you just stopped in here?" He said, "Milwaukee." Well, Roger lived in Chicago, and in calling on a customer in Milwaukee, he naturally went by the way of Marshfield in the northern part of the state. Well, doesn't everyone? Son Roger and June had had a love affair going through the years. I suspect he looks on June as his real mother more than his real businesswoman mother. Roger, a tremendous son, and we see him and wife often. We are so blessed with sons. The 1st of July that year, we moved to Brainerd and took over our radio station, KVBR. Weak as she was, June stepped in the office and took the place of two girls who moved on.